Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and welcome to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. And this is Tuesday, October 7th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And tonight's topic is fine-tuning the murder machine. And tonight I'm going to share with you special information your doctor receives that if he believes these and follows these directions, it can be expected to increase the murder count. And we're going to cover things like how doctors are being told to deal with vaccine refusers, how the Affordable Health Care Act is impacting Latinos, unnecessary chemotherapy, and the double standard, if you say the double standard of care, and more. So tonight's going to be really exciting. So let's jump right into those darn vaccine refusers. Now, there are many views on vaccines, so I'm just going to just stick with what's generally agreed upon. Okay, so those of you who have been following the latest scandal at the CDC, CDC has admitted that they have cooked the data. They've altered, refused to count certain individuals in their autism studies. Individuals, of course, who had autism were not counted. And they had all kinds of reasons for this that, depending on what you want to believe, may or may not have been valid, but had the data points been counted, it would have shown that the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine actually does increase autism threefold, so that's more than 300%. And so what doctors are being told is that everybody needs to be vaccinated, especially children, and they're going so far as to give doctors special instructions on how to deal with vaccine refusers. Now, the issue with vaccine refusers, and presumably it's supposed to be a good thing to have vaccines. However, again, we know that vaccines cause autism. The CDC did their own studies independently showing that. If you read the package inserts, most vaccine inserts do include, in fact, all of them include death as a side effect. And it's pretty difficult to justify giving a vaccine with death as a side effect when you're vaccinating against an illness that has not occurred in the United States, or if it does occur, has not been deadly. So this is the state of affairs that people or parents are facing. And so what are doctors being told? Now, when I was going to medical school, doctors were told, if somebody refuses vaccines, that's it, it's over. You take that mother and you tell her that she's a lousy person and you refuse to provide any medical care of any kind for that child. I don't care if it's a hangnail. I don't care if it's fixing a laceration. just refuse therapy. So that standard of care has changed. And so let's take a look and see if I can... take a look at that. So now what doctors are being told is you should not refuse care. If a mother wants to refuse vaccines, you should agree to continue providing medical care for the family and gently bring up vaccines again and again and again. And doctors are also being advised to refer such people to doctors who have a leaning towards natural therapies but do support vaccines. And so this is what we're being told. Also, doctors are being told to be human with these refusers and to share their personal history. So one particular doctor says, you know, I have three children, I vaccinated them, I had my concerns, but I did it anyway and my three kids are fine. Another example that was given is another doctor said, you know, I'm aware of an autistic kid who was not vaccinated. Therefore, vaccines can't possibly cause autism. And so it's interesting that in defense of vaccines, the doctors are being told to resort to anecdotal evidence or anecdotal methods when the very same types of proof are condemned when talking about natural therapies. And so, of course, if vaccines were so helpful, there would be some overwhelming evidence of their help. And so it's really striking and very telling that when doctors are told to deal with vaccine refusers, the doctors are actually not given any scientific statistics to point to. Instead, doctors are told to use anecdotal stories. They are told to continue to ask the woman gently again and again to get her to vaccinate. They're told to listen to the refuser, to let them get all of their objections out, everything, and say, okay, great. Now that we've listened to that, let's go ahead and vaccinate. And so basically, doctors are being given a very high-level sales lesson when it comes to dealing with vaccine refusers. Instead of resorting to quoting scientific fact or scientific studies showing that vaccines are effective. And so one can conclude then that either those studies are lacking or that this vaccine thing is a different kind of case. But I'd have to deduce that the studies are lacking because certainly the evidence, for example, for the polio vaccine, is in the United States, that would be, I'm saying the continental United States, that would be Mexico, United States, and Canada. The only cases of polio are in people who have been vaccinated. So apparently this information is not widely shared with doctors, and doctors aren't encouraged to share this with vaccine refusers. And so instead, irrational reasoning such as, I don't want my child to die, so I'm going to vaccinate. Never mind drawing a cause and effect link between vaccines and not dying. If you look at the package insert, the causal link is between vaccines and dying. That's if you read the package insert. So this is how doctors are being told to deal with vaccine refusers. They're basically told to resort to high-end sales techniques and to be patiently persistent, and that it is a battle that will be won over a period of several years, not in one office visit, and it should not be allowed to overshadow the therapeutic relationship. Very, very interesting. So what else do we have here in our litany of information? This is interesting. Now, this is a story that's in the news that involves doctors. And so how the media covers these stories actually influences how doctors perceive themselves as well as how doctors perceive perceive patients and other events. So this is an interesting story, and this is from Michigan. The Michigan doctor admits to putting patients through unnecessary chemotherapy. Now, I'm going to read you what the doctor was accused of, what he actually did, and then I'm going to go to the Mayo Clinic site and see what the Mayo Clinic has to say about this. So let's check this out. Okay, so necessary chemotherapy. A doctor pled guilty Tuesday to 13 counts of health care fraud, 2 counts of money laundering, and 1 count of conspiracy to defraud the United States, according to court records. Now, conspiracy to defraud the United States means that he billed a United States insurance program, that would be Medicare or Medicaid, for these chemotherapies. Okay. So judge was scheduled, U.S. District Judge Borman was scheduled on Tuesday to hear arguments on a motion from this doctor's lawyers seeking to suppress evidence gained from the Oakland County doctor's email account. Instead, the doctor, who was facing 29 total counts of health care fraud, conspiracy, and other charges, appeared before the judge and pled guilty to most of them. He was accused of administering unnecessary cancer treatments to patients who were either terminal, that means close to death, or in remission, that means they had no evidence of cancer. So far, sounds reasonable. The accusations were based on FBI interviews with employees of the doctor's Michigan Hematology Oncology Centers, that means blood cancer centers, which included offices in blah, blah, blah. There were allegations of deliberate misdiagnosis to justify cancer treatments, that means he told people they had cancer when they didn't, and administration of chemotherapy to terminal patients who would not benefit from treatment, and fabricated diagnoses of anemia and fatigue to justify unnecessary treatment and distribution of prescription drugs at dangerous levels. Okay. One cancer doctor who worked for the accused told investigators he was so disturbed by one case that he advised the patient never to return to FATA's office after chemotherapy treatment was ordered, even though the cancer was inactive. So the crime here is that chemotherapy treatment was ordered even though the cancer was inactive. The oncologist described working for this doctor as living with this hell, according to court documents. Now, this sounds very plausible. I mean, if you were working for somebody who was administering unnecessary chemotherapy and hastening people's death and torturing them and causing them pain, that's pretty intolerable. I'd go along with that. And other cancer treatments between August 07 and July 2013, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, let's see what the Mayo Clinic says about this. I said we always need to go check authoritative sources here. We don't want to have any bias, no negative bias here. So let me move over here to, here we are. Now, in medicine, we have something called adjuvant therapy. This is chemotherapy given to cancer patients who have no evidence of disease. And this is a Mayo Clinic site. And it says, understand your options before you decide whether adjuvant therapy is for you. Balance the side effects with the benefits of treatment when making your decision. So, of course, if you have no cancer, what could the benefits possibly be? Yes, exactly. So you've had surgery to take out your tumor, and your surgeon says all the cancer is removed. Yet, you've been referred to another doctor to consider more treatment called adjuvant therapy. You may wonder why you need additional therapy when your cancer has already been removed. Even if your cancer surgery was successful in removing all visible cancer, there may be a chance that your cancer could return. Of course, there's a good chance it won't, but there's a big chance it could. Doctors feel this may be due to microscopic bits of cancer that may remain and are undetectable with current methods. Now, this is the same spiel that this criminal doctor gave to his patients, I'm sure. But on the Mayo Clinic site, it's the standard of care. It's not a crime. But the added benefit of adjuvant therapy doesn't come without a price. The side effects can be more than minor inconvenience. So which treatments are used as adjuvant therapy? Chemotherapy, hormone therapy, radiation therapy, immunotherapy, targeted therapy. And so what the Mayo Clinic is saying is it's okay to give chemotherapy to people who have no evidence of cancer. This is good. But wait, we have a doctor here who's being arrested for providing chemotherapy to people who have no evidence of cancer. Where is the crime? How is it okay for the Mayo Clinic to advocate this, and it's not okay for a doctor in his private office on the corner of 7th and Main to do this? Well, let's just talk about how this leads to tightening the noose on the murder machine. Running an article like this, what it says to patients is, don't worry, it's safe out there. The FBI is on the case. Doctors are not giving chemotherapy to people who have no signs of cancer because, look, they're prosecuting and arresting this doctor, and so the problem is being solved. So that gives patients false sense of security and puts them in a position or a mindset to say yes when they read this on the Mayo Clinic site. That's number one. So you have a victim population that's much more willing. But even more insidious is this tells doctors, now doctors have a different slant on this, that you cannot freelance. You cannot give chemotherapy to healthy people who don't have cancer unless you have the protection of the Mayo Clinic. So unless you're working for a large hospital or you're working for a large clinic, but you certainly can't do it on your own. And so that's really what this article is saying. So, for example, for me, as a doctor practicing medicine, I would read this stuff. And I would say, oh, my God. Well, this guy's giving adjuvant chemotherapy. Why adjuvant chemotherapy, which is chemotherapy given to someone who has no sign of cancer, is totally within the standard of care. You mean this guy was following the standard of care in his private office and he gets arrested. But if we do it at a teaching hospital, it's not a problem. And so what this does then is it creates a flood of people going to large institutions and receiving care for cancer they don't have and refusing to go to private practice doctors to get therapy for care for conditions that they don't have. And so for doctors, it creates the legal understanding that to give chemotherapy to someone who has no cancer is legal and okay if I get a job with the Mayo Clinic. It's not legal and okay if I do it in my own private office. Now, again, the patient reading the same article is not aware of, you know, you didn't go to medical school, and when you read this, you don't spring to mind the word adjuvant therapy. Oh, my God, that's adjuvant therapy. Because, of course, adjuvant therapy is not a term used among lay people who are not in the throes of cancer. And, again, it's a specialized term that's used to give you the impression that what's going on is different from what this, I guess we could say, criminal did. And so giving doctors this message encourages them to participate in what has now become mass murder under the guise of protecting patients. Very interesting. So there's more to worry about in Detroit than getting mugged. And so As I said before, the real deal here is the Mayo Clinic does it. It's not a crime. Private doctor does it. It is a crime. Why? Any individual doctor is not an insider. This individual doctor has not paid his dues. He has not bribed any politicians. He's not on the inside decision-making. And he can only commit these crimes, which is what the Attorney General calls it, under the protection of an institution, no freelancing. Another thing to notice, I didn't stress, that this doctor is a foreign-born doctor. This is important, not because foreigners are good or bad, but because this doctor was foreign-born, he was not culturally conditioned to grasp this nuanced double standard, that it's okay for an institution like the Mayo Clinic to do it, but not okay for a private doctor to do it. So as someone who's not steeped in the American culture, he would say, wait, this is what the Mayo Clinic's doing, this is what the hospital's doing, I'll just do the same thing in my private office. And so that reasoning process would never happen in the mind of someone born in the United States, educated in the government educational system and government college system and government medical schools, because they would understand that distinction. Now, just so you guys know, just not to put too fine a point on it, but just to let you know, the doctor gets 20% of the healthcare dollar. And this percentage has been constant since 1980, which is when I first started tracking it. Now, this lack of fluctuation in the percentage of the healthcare dollar that goes to the doctor suggests that there's a lot of rules and a lot of structure in place to keep it this way. And it's called the standard of care. So it may as well be called the economic allocation system. In other words, when the doctor sticks to the standard of care, he never exceeds his 20% take. The only way a doctor is going to get more than 20% of the healthcare dollar is to deviate from the standard of care. Now, an example of this is in my office. A patient would come to my office. I would charge them a certain amount of money, and they would pay me. Now, when they left my office, they did not get a lab test. They did not get a prescription. They got a little note, you know, what foods to eat, maybe a couple of supplements to buy, and that was it. So basically, as far as that patient was concerned, I ended up keeping 100% of the healthcare dollar. Now, at a regular medical standard of care visit, that patient would have come in, I would have charged my visit, whatever it was, it doesn't matter what the number is. It could be $200, it could be $1,000, doesn't matter. But if a doctor is sticking to the standard of care, then whatever the price of his visit is, he's going to order four times that amount in laboratory tests, medications, and other procedures and interventions. And so when a doctor sticks to the standard of care, his take never exceeds 20%. He can be a highly paid $1 million-a-year neurosurgeon or whatever highly paid specialties are still out there. If he sticks to the standard of care, and the number of tests he orders, procedures he orders, hospital days he orders, in other words, admits a person to the hospital and they consume hospital days. At the end of the year, when the dust settles, you add up all the money the doctor's collected, and not even his profit, just his gross, before he pays his staff or any insurances or anything, that amount is one-fifth of the dollar amount of what he received, the hospital costs incurred by patients that he admitted to the hospital, the cost of prescriptions that he wrote, the cost of x-rays that he wrote. And so this is actually a very easy, quick way to track a doctor. If a doctor's revenue is more than one-fifth of the total of his charges and tests and hospitalizations and drugs that he orders, then you know he's not sticking to the standard of care. And so this is really a very simple policing mechanism, actually. And now with electronic health records And with pharmacy tracking of records, a doctor's total revenue that he generates for hospitals, for drug companies, for insurance companies can be tracked. And so you can immediately spot a doctor who's deviating from the standard of care just by these financial numbers. Very interesting. Now, another thing about this case in terms of cancer is this doctor clearly overstepped his bounds. Now, you want to note the cooperation of the Mayo Clinic, the federal prosecution system, and the media were needed to pull this off. There's no investigative reporter saying, wait a minute, sounds like a Juvian Care to me. Let me do a side-by-side comparison to a Juvian Care and what this doctor did and ask the Mayo Clinic to comment on this. And no such article was written. And so, again, this article has the net effect of creating suspicion of doctors in solo practice, of foreign doctors, and gives a false assurance that the problem is being handled and that large clinics and domestically trained doctors or domestic born doctors are not doing the same thing. And so this court that convicted this doctor basically presided over a turf encroachment. He encroached on the turf of hospitals and institutions, and thus the court system, the FBI, preserved the monopoly of hospitals and large clinics, and actually right in plain view. And so this kind of behavior, again, tightens the noose and makes it more likely that people will experience murder by medicine. Now, this is another one, this next one, one close to my heart, is, of course, murder, because that's my big objection. Murder by medicine. I think that people are all destined to die, and why should they have to pay tens of thousands of dollars for the privilege and be tortured in the process? So, I'm going to precede this one with a joke. Many of you know I write these little jokes. And so, I've been very busy with my clients lately, so I haven't really, I should say I felt guilty about writing jokes, but today I wrote a few jokes. And these two guys are talking, and these two guys are in the hood, and they're trying to sort something out because it's something they don't understand. So one guy says, my doctor told me I was brain dead. Should I feel insulted? And the second guy says, nah, man, that's a compliment. It means he thinks your organs are healthy enough for transplant. Let's take a look. And this is what your doctor got in his mailbox, and the topic is why brain death is death. Now, of course, I would ask myself, well, why does anyone need to be convinced that brain death is death? I mean, why would such an article appear in my doctor mailbox unless apparently somebody is resisting this definition of brain death? So let's see what the fuss is about. All right, here we are. Oh my gosh. Every now and then. Okay, here we are. Nope, this is testosterone. I don't want to know about testosterone. I want to know about brain death. That's another one we have to talk about, is testosterone. Submit it. Okay, why brain death is death? Now, again, some things, just the fact that they're being discussed is a serious red flag. And they say in the final weeks of December 2013, a 13-year-old girl from Oakland, California, went into Children's Hospital and Research Center for a tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy, and removal of redundant sinus tissue. That's a lot of surgery for a 13-year-old, but what the heck. Tragically, complications ensued. Okay. And this little girl was declared legally dead on December 12th, following two assessments by the hospital's neurologist and pediatric intensive care specialist. The family requested that her care continue, but the hospital said it was no longer obligated to continue providing medical care as the child was dead. Okay, this is December 12, 2013, and the date on this article is September 19, 2014, so pretty recent here, less than a month ago. So today, this little girl continues to receive care. In other words, her heart's beating. She's alive. At a facility that agreed to take her after Children's Hospital released her body. The facility has fitted her with a feeding tube, and her mother gives her a weekly manicure and pedicure. Okay, so we know her nails are growing. So if her nails are growing, her heart's beating, she's getting food. And they're saying it's a Facebook page where people can write encouraging messages for her family. At this writing, there have been 26,000 likes since her mother joined Facebook after her daughter was declared brain dead. And so what they're saying to doctors is this case has garnered widespread media attention and has led to legal quagmire. The Mayo Clinic physicians decided, you got to keep up with the Mayo Clinic because they keep up with the standard of care. The Mayo Clinic physicians decided to analyze the pertinent medical, legal, and ethical issues raised by this case to help doctors and others respond to questions about brain death. Now, so this article is designed to help your doctor respond to questions about brain death. Now, remember, this is a perfectly healthy girl who went in for a surgery, experienced a complication, and now they're declaring her brain dead. And they told the parents, look, withdraw all support and let her die. And the parents said, no. You know, she's human. As far as we're concerned, you know, she's got a heartbeat. Her nails are growing. She's assimilating nutrition. And we're just going to take care of her. Okay. So this is what they're telling your doctor. So your doctor understands that brain death is irreversible, determined by absent motor responses, loss of brainstem reflexes, and not breathing after certain tests. It's not determined by further waiting. Support measures often fail, and the ability to maintain a brain-dead body is virtually impossible. Okay, so now this brain-dead body has been maintained for several months, since December, as a matter of fact. So this brain-dead body has been maintained for 10 months. And so this particular case totally contradicts what they're telling the doctors to believe. But again, if you're a doctor, you're already slipped into a trance. You're like, this is way complicated. All right, so support measures often fail, and the ability to maintain a brain-dead body is virtually impossible. They add that brain death is a distinct clinical neurological state different from all other manifestations of acute or prolonged coma, where patients may eventually be able to breathe on their own and when some or all brainstem reflexes are preserved. So what they're saying is this girl's in a coma different from other comas. It's a special kind of coma. Okay. In the medical judgment of practicing neurointensivists and neurosurgeons in all neurological science societies, academics throughout the world, brain death constitutes death of the person, they write. Okay, so if the brain dies, then the person dies. Now, obviously, we know this lady's heart is beating, so the heart's not dead. We know her intestines are assimilating whatever's going through that tube, so the intestines aren't dead. We know that her nails are growing because her mother's clipping them, therefore the nails aren't dead. So, obviously, brain death cannot constitute death. Assuming it's not constituting death of the body in this case. The death of the person might be another nuance, a legal term. Standing for determining pediatric brain death standards were determined more than 25 years ago and have been adopted and revisited by the Society of Critical Care Medicine. Okay, so these standards have been changed by voting of a group of people vote periodically and change the standards. So the American Academy of Pediatrics and Child Neurology Society diagnosis is a guidelines released in 2011. So 2011 is the latest set of guidelines. Requires two examinations in 12 hours, apart by two different doctors in children 1 year or older. And on the other hand, a brain death diagnosis requires just one full examination with optional confirmation by another physician. All right. So adult brain death requires one physician. Childhood brain death diagnosis requires two. And Dr. Burke and his colleagues acknowledge that they do not know the exact medical details surrounding this particular girl, but they do have access to the description of the neurological exam of the court-appointed neurologist. The examination shows a full neurological exam, tests that she's not breathing, a flatline brainwave test, and a nuclear scan with no demonstrable uptake. All right. Now we got to get to the punchline here. The fact that she's still supported by artificial means, although remarkable, is not exclusive of a diagnosis of brain death. In other words, they're pointing out what I said, which is, hey, she's alive after 10 months. Doesn't really fit your definition of brain death. And they're saying, well, we know she's been living a little bit long, but we're still going to stick by our guns. She was brain dead. All right. In exceptional cases, prolonged support is possible as long as oxygenation, circulation, nutrition, and treatment of multiple medical complications is provided. So she was declared dead by the hospital, and 18 days later, the county superior court judge upheld the declaration. So the judge, the court say, hey, yep, she's dead. And they agreed that her death met the definition set out by the California's Uniform Determination of Death Act. Okay. The act states that blah, blah, blah. And so the important thing to understand is why brain death is death. Now, there's a lesson to be learned in this case. It is that there's a greater need to communicate this consensus to members of the public. In other words, we need to get the public to accept this death. The problem here is not that the patient wasn't appropriately declared dead, but that the family failed to accept the pronouncement of the doctors. And to those who report medical news, an informed public is the best defense against unanticipated outcry in aberrant cases such as this. In other words, they don't want the public to resist, which means your resistance is actually very important. And we encourage our colleagues in critical care and biomedical ethics to engage patients and local communities around matters related to brain death, they conclude. And so the reality of brain death may be difficult for families to come to terms with, he said. There are counterintuitive aspects of brain death. Counterintuitive means things that don't make sense because the patient's heart is still beating, blood is circulating. Patients do not look like they're dead in terms of the traditional understanding of what a dead body looks like. That is one factor that can make brain death hard to understand. The proper term for brain death would be death determined by the absence of brain function. And so this would be to show that it is death. It isn't just that the brain is dead, but that the person is dead. There's no clear way to say it shorthanded. All the clear descriptions are a sentence or a long phrase. So brain death has caught on. It's a short name. It's the vernacular. So it's not something that's going to go away. Now, the points that need to be communicated are that it's hopeless, irreversible, and that there's no benefit for any type of treatment. It's accepted as death in the law, and it offers an opportunity for organ donation. Hey, their words, not mine. There's your punchline. This is why brain death is death, because it offers an opportunity for organ donation. The possibility of organ donation should be raised, but carefully, he added. Now, if you're a real cynic, you could say they saw this poor kid coming. 13-year-old girl? Phenomenal organs? Yeah. General anesthesia for a tonsillectomy and finance and this and that? Oh, yeah. And you can imagine the utter disappointment when the parent says, no, my child is not dead. No, we're not giving up the organs. So what's the purpose of this article? It's to convince doctors that brain death is death, even though it's obviously, in this case, not death. The patient's obviously alive. Like I said, she's getting her toenails cut and she's circulating blood, consuming food. You know, you can say what you want. You know, one could criticize her quality of life, possibly. But because you don't approve of someone's quality of life, doesn't that necessarily give you the right to take their life. So there is some life going on here. And so this is really an appalling case, because what we have here is iatrogenic brain death. What we have here is a healthy girl came to the hospital for, I'm sure it was presented to her parents as a harmless surgery for tonsil, you know, get her tonsils out. She becomes a vegetable, and of course, yeah, get those organs. And the parents say, no, we're going to shower our daughter with love. We're going to visit her. We're going to give her the best possible quality of existence. It may not be what every other 13-year-old girl or 14-year-old girl has, but we're going to do the best we can. And as you can see, the medical establishment, and I'm not saying doctors, but the medical establishment, whoever's calling the shots here, whoever's setting the standard of care, is absolutely livid. Now, in a prior show, I discussed this, and we discussed that one body fully transplanted generates $11.4 million of revenue for the healthcare industry. So this was a serious loss that the parents did not accept the definition of brain death, and that the conversation for organ donation could not take place. And they say that right here, that this is an opportunity for organ donation, and the possibility of organ donation should be raised. And so they wanted those organs, and the parents said, not so fast. And so another tightening of the noose in the murder machine. All right, here's another article, what they're telling your doctor to help him be a more effective murderer. FDA panel rejects new oral testosterone replacement. That sounds pretty good. That's like, oh, wow, you know, FDA is looking out for us. They actually said no to something. But let's take a look. Let's look a little deeper. So what's the story here? The story here is testosterone, unless you've been under a rock, you've noticed, is being sold as an anti-aging drug, and it increases heart disease, and by inference, of course, death from heart disease by 1%. How can a drug extend life if it increases death? These are the testosterone preparations that are already approved. So doctors are being told it's okay to prescribe the ones that are already approved and keep it up, and good job. So let's take a look at this to see what they had to say. A combined United States Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee has voted against recommending approval of oral, that means you can swallow it with your mouth, testosterone gel capsules as testosterone replacement therapy. In a joint session today of the Bone Reproductive and Urological Drugs Advisory Committee and the Drug Safety and Risk Management Advisory Committee, panelists voted 12-8 with one abstention that there is not enough evidence to conclude that the testosterone prodrug is effective. They voted 18-3 that the overall benefit risk profile is not acceptable to support approval. Okay. So first they say in their vote that it's not effective. Then they say that the benefit-risk profile is not acceptable, which means they feel it's a risk. Okay. While most panel members consistently call for more data on effectiveness and safety, others contend that the drug manufacturer had proved its case for the brand name drug and that a definite need exists for an oral formulation. Okay, so there's a brand name drug already on the market, which has gotten the okay. So it's like, hey, we're using a generic, you know, why are you making us jump through all these hoops? And we're making it oral. And so the meeting followed the previous day's hearing by the same group. And so because of widespread use of testosterone replacement therapy for natural age-related small balls and for signs and symptoms of men with low testosterone, who often may not need a drug or weren't even tested. So in other words, signs and symptoms, which means they didn't get a test. So a lot of guys are being prescribed this testosterone. And so what this guy is saying, so some panels, by the way, said yes to the effectiveness. And they said if you apply the same criteria to other testosterone replacement therapies in the market, most of them would fail. And so this appears to be a double standard being applied by the FDA. And so Keith Gordon, PhD, industry representative, and a non-voting panelist added, I'm concerned that this is being judged today rather than yesterday. So what he's saying is they're using two different standards. And we'd rather use the standard that was used yesterday to approve all the drugs that are already in the market rather than changing the rules and denying this drug. Now, we can cut to the chase here. So all this yak-a-yak back and forth means that the FDA panel rejected a new testosterone replacement drug, but the ones already on the market are dangerous. The ones that are already on the market are causing heart disease. And so they're saying that compared to results of treatment with androgel, a topical gel applied to the skin, both treatments meet the primary endpoint of effectiveness. And so what this says to doctors is that the FDA is not perfect, but at least the FDA is protecting somebody, I guess that would be patients, from more dangerous drugs being approved. But by the way, it's okay to keep using the ones that are already approved. And so again, this encourages doctors to proceed to prescribe these class of drugs, even though they have these hazards. And so they're just giving doctors the go-ahead, saying, hey, it's okay. So the FDA research has also presented safety issues uncovered in the trials, including worse cardiovascular risk compared with androgel, which has a 1%, larger decreases in HDL cholesterol and a greater increase in blood pressure. Whoa. That means that the drug already in the market increases or decreases HDL, increases blood pressure, and increases heart disease. And so this drug does the same thing, only there's a feeling, a sense, that it does it maybe a little more. You know, all the money being poured into lowering cholesterol, you would think the FDA would disapprove any drug that worsened a person's cholesterol profile. But that's not the case. We have all these testosterone drugs on the market. I find this a bit of an annoyance. I get a call from my brother every 18 months now. He says, Jennifer, should I be taking a testosterone drug? I said, no, Matthew, you don't need to take a testosterone drug. It's just going to make you beat your wife and have a heart attack. I mean, why bother? Oh, okay. And the ads are so creative that he doesn't even realize it's the same old drug they're advertising. But this is what doctors are fed that helps them stick to dangerous, and more dangerous drugs. We have 10 minutes left. If people have questions, they can click their question button there. We have one more story to cover, but I'm not sure if we have time to cover it. So this will be a good time to take questions. All right, let me find my question box. Oh, right over there. I have this button on my computer that I can click. It helps me find everything, but not this time. Aha, here we are. All right, so let's see if we have any questions. Scroll up and scroll down. And let's check our chat room. Oh, I'm sorry, I should give you guys a call-in number. The call-in number is 914-338-0695. It's 914-338-0695. And let's take a look at the chat room. All right, let's see if there's any questions in the chat room. Well, I'm waiting for the chat room to load. Oh, okay. Chat room's got a few questions. Okay, what was the outcome for the little girl? The outcome for the little girl was the little girl is in a permanent vegetative state. She's in a long-term care facility, and her parents are visiting her and, you know, providing, you know, care and kindness. So the question from the chat room is, can a family doctor order the doctor to inject her with a bolus of vitamin C? No. Family does not have the power to write orders at all. They might harass the doctor until he does write orders, but the family doesn't have the right to have the doctor inject the vitamin C. Now, if they were a ballsy family, they could just bring in the vitamin C or bolus inject it themselves. There's got to be a few portal access points. Or she's got a feeding tube, just put it down the feeding tube. But, I mean, you know, not to create problems for the poor facility who's agreed to take care of this girl. Chat room, they're very helpful. It's what is a body worth? That's my prior radio show where I document that a fully transplanted body generates $11.4 million in medical revenue. Okay. What is the name? Okay. Who talks about organ transplant? Okay. I don't know. Oh, what was the doctor sentenced to? The doctor who was given unnecessary chemotherapy? I believe he was actually sentenced to prison time. This is interesting. And chat room, does any population adapt to toxic environment? Do we somehow find nutritional value in pesticides? The answer is, actually what happens is the pesticides are stored in our fat. The pesticides are stored in our parasites. The parasites in our bodies actually eat the pesticides and store them. And so what we do is we kind of reach a new level of equilibrium and coexistence with the pesticides. Okay. So, we have a question.
In your opinion,
My
name is Kelly, but in your opinion, turpentine and pregnancy, are you okay with that?
No way. I am not okay with it.
That's all I wanted to check on. I appreciate your time.
Okay. All right.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay. Yeah, I'm totally not okay with it, even though I am aware of several people who've gotten pregnant while taking turpentine. They've all stopped it in the first trimester and had excellent babies. But I definitely would not recommend starting it during pregnancy. Okay. So we have 4 minutes left. So let's take a look at this last little piece here. Antibiotic stewardship metrics. Doctors, priorities. This sounds like really, really abstruse and difficult to comprehend, which, of course, it's meant to be. So, first of all, what is antibiotic stewardship? What are metrics? And what are doctors' priorities? These are all, like, really vague. So antibiotic stewardship is a program created by the CDC in response to the high incidence and death rate from antibiotic-resistant infections. And so what the CDC said is, hey, you hospitals, you have got to create an antibiotic stewardship program whereby you have a program that encourages the responsible use of antibiotics so that we have fewer issues with antibiotic-resistant infections. That sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, I thought so too. So for antibiotic stewardship. That's a program in the hospital designed to use antibiotics responsibly. And metrics is what the program measures, and doctors' priorities differ. Okay, so doctors' priorities is what's important to doctors, and what's measured by this program doesn't seem to fit that. Okay, so here's the clincher. They start off with the punchline, right? Clinicians consider patient outcomes to be more important than cost, but the antibiotic stewardship program rarely measure patient outcomes. How can you determine if an antibiotic is being used responsibly if you don't even measure patient outcomes? And this is the essence of the deadly information doctors get. Doctors are receiving information and research not based on patient outcome, but based on other criteria. So I have 6 seconds, end of the program. We'll see you again next week. And next week we're going to talk about what does Dr. Daniels do when she's sick. So that's going to be our program for next week. What would Dr. Daniels do? And so that's what we're going to talk about next week. And if I had an engineer, he would be playing music. I don't have an engineer, so he's not playing music. We did not have time to talk about the Ebola outbreak today, I'm sorry to say. Oh, wait, we have one more question. Let's see what we can.
Yes.
Hi, you have a question. You're on here.
I have a question about, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
I've got a patient who's a 95-year-old woman who has a wound on the chin of her, the shin of her left foot. And it's not healing. What would you suggest we do with that?
95 years old, not healing wound in the shin. First of all, you've probably been to the wound clinic, or maybe she has. So
no.
Know what that can get you. Oh, she hasn't.
No.
Oh, okay. If she has a malnutrition problem, so you need to take a look at her nutrition. Most likely it would be a protein malnutrition, but her problem is basically malnutrition, and that'll heal up real nicely once you remedy that. Now, I want to tell people, you got to go to vitalitycapsules.com, sign up for the mailing list. So we're going to have a 3-hour heal-a-thon where people can call in and ask any question they want. And so you got to sign up for the list at vitalitycapsules.com. You click on vitalitycapsules.com, click on Contact Us, and then you'll see a sign-up box in the upper right corner. You get a great free report, and you'll be on the list, and you'll get an invitation to the Heal-a-thon. All right, wonderful. So we'll see you again next week, and you'll find out what Dr. Daniels would do.